In the Canadian justice system, animals' interests are rarely represented, but the lawyers at Animal Justice fight to give them a voice in court and the political system. This is the Paw and Order Podcast, and these are their stories.
Welcome to episode 2 of the Paw and Order Podcast. I'm Peter Sankoff, joined today by my co-host in person, Camille Lapchuk.
Hi, everyone.
Wow, this is very exciting. We're only 2 episodes in and we're already in the same location. Can't believe it's happened that fast.
It's pretty cool. So I am here in Edmonton this week with Peter. I'm in the Faculty of Law at the University of Alberta, where Peter teaches.
The posh Paw and Order Podcast studio.
Yeah, i.e. Peter's desk. I'm sitting on one corner, he's sitting on the other corner. Very professional.
Yeah, very exciting. I think when we planned this, we envisioned that we'd be doing most of our podcasts remotely. And for the next 2, there's a little teaser, we're going to be sitting right next to each other. So very exciting to be able to do this. I'm sure it is going to be a super fun show. We turned up the weather here in Edmonton. We decided to give Camille a real Western sunny day and nice and cold. So welcome to Alberta, Camille.
Well, it feels just like Ottawa, which is my current home, because Ottawa has been freezing all winter long. So I kind of feel like Edmonton was just expecting me and is trying to make me feel at home. It's not so bad.
Fantastic. Well, we are delighted to have you here in Edmonton. I can tell you that Camille is here for a number of reasons. She is visiting with my animal law class tomorrow and giving a talk here at the University of Alberta.
I'm very excited. I'm going to talk to students about some of the work that animal justice does and kind of review a few of the major problems with animal law. So sometimes the laws are bad, sometimes the enforcement is bad, and more importantly, animals just usually have no way to get into court. And what I'm going to give people hope with, I hope, is that animal justice is doing some work to tackle all of these issues. So that's the public talk. And then there's the talk in Peter's class, which is more about what's it like to practice animal law? What does animal justice do on a day-to-day basis? And some fun stuff like that.
Should be fantastic. And I can tell you that Camille, the jet setter, is not stopping here. This is just the first on her roller coaster ride across the West. Why don't you tell us a little bit about what's up next?
Yeah, I'm sort of calling this Camille Goes West 2018. So I was in Calgary visiting my dad, and I took the bus up to Edmonton yesterday. Tomorrow night, after all the talks, I'm flying out to Kamloops because I'm visiting our friend Katie Sykes out there. And Katie Sykes teaches animal law at Thompson Rivers University.
I'd say she is a good friend of the podcast, but that's not clear yet. I do not give out the term good friend of the podcast lightly. So at this moment, there are no good friends of the podcast, but we'll say a good friend. How's that?
She's a good
Katie
friend.
Sykes is a good friend.
Good friend of the podcast has to be.
You got
to
do more.
Yeah.
You gotta really bring it to the podcast to get the good friend moniker. So we'll say she's a good friend.
Yeah. And I'm sure we'll have her on at some point to offer her insight. But I'm talking in her animal law class on Thursday, and then on Friday, heading out to Vancouver for a Canadian Bar Association event on animal law, and I'm wrapping it up with a talk in Denver at a really, really cool legal symposium with most of the top U.S. animal rights lawyers. So I can't wait.
Should be fantastic. A lot of good stuff going on. Now, I have waited about 3 minutes and I'm not going to wait any longer because we've been just talking about stuff we're doing. If we want to talk about something that's got us really excited, oh my God, it is the response to Paw and Order. It has been super exciting and we can't thank our listeners enough.
Yeah, the first episode came out just a week ago, and we've already had over 1,400 listens. We've had, we just checked the reviews on iTunes, and there's a bunch of 5-star reviews, and many of you guys left really positive ratings, and we're just so blown away by it.
It's pretty amazing. I got to say, so I've been a law prof, and let's just say I've done a couple of cool things. I've gone to the Supreme Court, whatever, a couple of books and whatever, but like this was the first time my alma mater, U of T, actually congratulated me on something I had done. You got to do a lot to get, apparently some people get congratulated more than others, but I have never once been congratulated by my alma mater where I graduated, but they posted this wonderful tweet to their 12,000 followers that said, congrats to alumni.
Yeah, that's
right. Camille and Peter. It was very exciting.
Yeah, U of T actually has graduated a lot of the animal lawyers in this country. And when we say U of T, that means U of Toronto for anyone not immersed in the legal community. But they've been really good to animal law. They've been really good to us. It's where I went. It's where I cut my teeth. It's where Leslie Bisgold teaches, the first Canadian animal rights lawyer. So it's a great spot.
It's pretty quirky and totally, in my opinion, like somewhat of a fluke. I remember we did the book launch of Canadian Perspectives on Animals and the Law. And it was just, we had never even considered the fact that all three of the editors, myself, Katie Sykes, and Vaughn Black, are alumni of U of T. So it was pretty, it was just, again, totally quirky. Had absolutely no idea of that. But it turns out you're right. A lot of people do have these U of T connections. Not all, but there are a lot. So we are very excited about the Pawn Order reception. We hope to continue to give you some really interesting content and some fun, entertaining content going forward. But again, just the feedback on Facebook, Twitter, and everywhere else has been really gratifying for us. And we're just, it motivated us. I got to tell you, like, I was bugging Camille on several occasions. Like, we got to do the next one. Like, we got to get it out there because there's just been so much good reception. But we're trying to be patient. We're trying to keep to a schedule that we'll be able to keep up with in the long run. And I know that we got to keep that initial excitement dampened enough to make sure that we can deliver the goods. So we hope to continue to put out quality product and we'll need some time to do that.
That's right. So we're still aiming for an episode every 2 weeks. Right now we're releasing on Friday. We'll let you know if that changes. Maybe we'll do it more frequently. Maybe we'll take a week off at some point, but we'll let you know.
Well, that's where the teaser starts, because just talking about what we've been up to since the last episode, I've been delving deep into my class on animals and the law, which is always a fun source of discussion. Camille's joining us there tomorrow, but it has been a lot of fun teaching animals and the law. It's one of the courses I enjoy the most.
How many times have you taught that class now, do you think?
Yeah,
Peter?
It's been a lot. God, I started, I'd have to go back, I would say 8 or 9 times. And I've taught it at some different institutions. That's probably more than that. But I've been doing it for a long time and playing with the format and changing it up a little bit, what I do. But it is always interesting to me to go back. That's one of the things I like most about it. Go back to some fundamentals. Go back and look at cases that I don't think about very much anymore. That's really an exciting part. So, I mean, first of all, I can tease that our next Paw and Order podcast, I hate to jump forward to episode 3, but we've decided we're going to do a live podcast answering questions and answers from my students, which I think is going to be a hell of a lot of fun. Since Camille is here, we thought that would be a really great idea to take advantage of that.
Yeah. And it's going to be kind of a special episode. We won't have most of the regular segments. We'll just sort of jump right into all the questions. And we've already seen some of the questions they're coming up with. Really smart stuff. Really gives us a great jumping off point for some interesting discussions. So I hope you guys are going to enjoy it.
Good job, students. And one of the things I wanted to remind myself to say is that, as I said, it's been fun going back through some of the old cases and things that I hadn't looked at. My favorite recently was we did a class on property the other day, which gave me a chance to get reacquainted with the IKEA monkey case and one of my favorite personalities in the law governing animals, Yasmin, correct?
Yasmin Nakuda.
Oh my God, the things I could say about her if I weren't concerned about libel laws. I got to watch, not only did, for any of you who are not familiar with what I'm talking about, just Google IKEA monkey or Yasmin Nakuda and you will get a treasure trove of videos that will surprise and amaze you with some of the things that this woman who owns a herd of monkeys and other animals living outside of Toronto now. I'm sure we'll talk about IKEA monkey.
I'm sure
at
that
some
case
point
will come up. It's one of the highest profile animal cases in Canadian history.
Yeah.
It was a ridiculous, ridiculous case. But, you know, essentially a monkey was found wandering around IKEA, baby monkey in a shearling coat, seized by animal services because it's illegal to have monkeys, and rightfully so, in the city. And some legal proceedings resulted.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a really fun case for property law. If you want to learn about property law and animals, it's a really good starting point because it shows how the designation of animal as properties, in this case, an application of property principles ended up to, I guess the best interest of the monkey. But that was just pure fluke by the way the case turned out. It's actually a really interesting case to see how treatment of animals in the legal system and treatment of them as property is really not something that's usually conducive to their interest and something that we've got to be, greatly concerned about. which yeah. we were and are. But really the highlight is interviews with Yasmin Nakuda, because honestly, if that doesn't show you how concerning it is that people have the absolute right to buy animals, especially exotic animals, nothing will. How's that? I restrained myself. I had lots of different adjectives I wanted to use to describe Yasmin, but I'm going to restrain myself.
That was very diplomatic, Peter. I'm proud.
So. I thought so. Well, Camille's been up to some things in the animal world herself.
I got a new cat.
That was delightful.
I'm so excited. So I had one cat already. Her name is Sadie, and she was adopted from a great group called Annex Cat Rescue in Toronto. And I was kind of getting the sense that Sadie would like a playmate. So I've been looking around for another cat for a while and trying to find one to adopt. And of course, I would always adopt a cat. I would never buy a cat or do anything else except rescue a loving animal who needs a home. So last weekend or the weekend before, finally went to PetSmart. And PetSmart, like most other pet stores these days, they don't sell cats or dogs. They help rescues adopt them out. So that's a really good place to look if you are trying to add a new animal family member to your house. And I walked in. There is a cage where usually there's four cats. There was just one in the cage. And her name is Cecily. And she's a tiny little black cat who looks a lot like my first cat, Sadie, actually. And it was basically love at first sight. She started snuggling my hand and purring and, you know, playing a little bit. And she was just way too cute not to take home. So she came home, and there were a couple hisses at first when they were introduced, but now they're kind of sleeping on the couch together. So I feel like this is the start of a beautiful friendship.
Wonderful. So I'm happy. Delightful. So my prayers go out to your furniture now that you have twice as many cats to shred. Yeah. Is that correct?
There's no hope for my furniture at this point.
Yeah, furniture is done.
The cats rule the house.
I've got to be honest. I will not be adopting cats anytime soon. I've had cats once in my life, and that was enough. I fall on the dog side of the spectrum. So if I'm going to get an animal, it's going to be a dog. This is it. I'm going to get hate mail from all the cat people.
Oh, I know. And I'm going to get hate mail from the dog people because I'm not a dog person. Right. I like them, but I don't want to have a dog. And I travel too much, I think, to really take care of one responsibly.
That is the first question I ask in my class, just to get some discussion going. Cat or dog, right? And, you know, you get variations on it. But I secretly side with all the dog people.
Oh, I didn't know that about you, Peter.
What can I tell you?
So what's new with you?
Not too much. It has been a busy time here. January is a very busy month, but I did have an interesting story that took place near the end of the holidays that I needed to share with our listeners because I thought it was just interesting. We don't do too many, like we're focused on the law. I'm sure we'll refer to some vegan stories because they sort of go hand in hand. But I had an interesting vegan story that happened to me, actually happened to my poor young son, who is 6 years old. His name is Oscar. He's super cute. He's been a vegan all his life. We've raised both our children that way. And, you know, he's learned about this growing up, and he understands what it is to be vegan.
Yeah, your kids know why they're vegan.
Oh,
and
yeah,
they're very
they get the whole
proud
thing.
Of their decision.
Absolutely. So in any event, we sent my kids to an all-day ski workshop. So they got to go skiing for a day, and it was great because it was, you know, we got them out of the house and they got to go skiing all day, and they had instructors, and it was fantastic. And it included lunch. Now, usually we're very careful about these things and, you know, we scout out, okay, what's going on with the lunch and what's happening. But anyway, we were a bit rushed that day. So we got there and we got to the ski hill, and they go off into their groups and we go check out, well, what's up with the lunch. So of course the lunch is not vegan. Of course, why would it be vegan? But it's essentially, they've got vegan French fries, right? So they got French fries and some fruit and some applesauce. So we're like, okay, kids, well, you can get by with French fries and we'll give you some snacks and whatever, and no problem. So we told Penny about this because we ran into my daughter before we left, but I couldn't find my son because he's up on the hill. So I told my daughter, I said, you got to be sure to tell Oscar that the macaroni and cheese and the chicken nuggets are not vegan. You can only eat the French fries. So Benny's like, okay, no problem. And off she goes. So then we get back at the end of the day and we come back and we look, and my son is distraught. He's got this sad face look on.
Uh-oh.
He's got this terrible sad face look going on. And we're like, what happened? And my wife tells me the story, and apparently Oscar was eating the chicken nuggets because he loves chicken nuggets. It's his favorite thing in the world, vegan
of course
ones.
He just assumes they're all vegan.
He assumes if it's there, that's what it is. So I asked Penny, well, what happened? And she's like, well, his group got in first. He just runs the line. So then, of course, Penny tells him, and he stops eating the nugget and spits out the one that he's eating. But he was so upset the whole day, and I felt so bad for him because it was my fault.
Oh, you didn't protect your son from that.
It was totally my fault. I was such a bad dad. I totally just couldn't find him and couldn't reach him. And we left. And I'm like, well, Penny will take care of it because she's really good at that. And never. So Oscar was really sad. And I'm like, buddy, it happens to all of us. In fact, it happened to Camille this morning.
It happened to me this morning. And I wasn't going to bring this up, but you did. So I'll talk about it. We went to this nice coffee shop right across the street from the law building. And Peter and I are yakking while we're ordering. And I was ordering a London Fog, which is like basically an Earl Grey latte. But I forgot to ask for soy milk. And I didn't realize I'd made this mistake until I got into the office I'm using for the day and sat down. And it was like, that sort of tastes funny. It's just like slightly off, right? And now I've still got this dairy aftertaste in my mouth.
Yeah, I've been there. I
tried to rinse it out with kombucha and it's not working.
Yeah.
Oh, well. Anyway, we all make mistakes. Veganism is not about being perfect. It's about doing
it's about
what you
the
can.
Attempt, which is what I told my son. I'm like, look, we're doing what we can. We try our hardest. Everybody's going to. We're going to get all the vegan stories. Please share your stories where you ate something you didn't want to eat. It's happened to all of us.
Yeah, make us feel less bad about
it. It's not the... anyway. Yeah. Okay, we better go on to the topic. Let's talk about some animal law things in the news, Camille. And I think the big one, which we didn't get to talk about last time, was the Vancouver Aquarium.
Yeah, yeah. So that's happened since we recorded the last podcast. But the Vancouver Aquarium... If anyone's been following this issue, you'll have noticed that they've been going through some stuff lately. So the park board in Vancouver, which has jurisdiction over the aquarium, told them that they can't keep whales and dolphins in captivity anymore. And this came after decades of advocacy, like tons of Vancouver residents, tons of animal groups, tons of people standing up and saying, you know, you have to stop keeping whales and dolphins in tanks. And just in the last year and a bit alone, there were 5 cetaceans left. There were a couple belugas and 3 dolphins left in early November of 2016. And a year later, 4 of them were dead. So there's only 1 dolphin left at this point at the aquarium named Helen. So, you know, the context of the news I'm about to share is that dolphin and whale captivity is on its way out across the country and especially at the aquarium. And it seems that the aquarium finally saw that the writing was on the wall because they made this announcement that they're going to stop confining whales and dolphins voluntarily at this point. So really interesting. What's especially interesting to animal justice about this whole situation is that we have an open court case with them.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, they were challenging the park board decision to ban them from keeping whales and dolphins. So they're making all these arguments on what we call a judicial review. Mm-hmm. And animal justice intervened in that case. And the reason we wanted to intervene is that one of the claims that they're making is that it infringes their constitutional right to free expression by being banned from keeping whales and dolphins in tanks.
Quite an audacious statement for those who follow constitutional law.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, this is essentially a free speech claim. Yeah. So you might think to yourself, what does confining animals in tanks have to do with free speech?
It's an artistic exhibition, Camille. That's really what's going on here. And we have the right to, you know, we paint the tanks, we show them in a particular way. That's art, right?
Yeah, that's basically what they're claiming. Yeah. And the worrying thing is that there's a couple cases. There's a circus case, especially in Ontario, where the circus won in part on a similar argument. So we were freaked out enough about this case to intervene. And what animal justice is telling the court is that free expression ends when violence begins.
Right.
That's a very well-recognized principle in constitutional law.
Right.
And we're saying it's violent to keep whales and dolphins in tanks because they suffer.
Yeah, it's an interesting argument. I've had some talks with the litigators on this, and I look forward to seeing what the court does with it. But I guess that's part of my question. Is the issue now moot? Is there any chance the court will refuse to go forward on this or that the litigants will drop their objection?
It doesn't look like it. So listeners who've been following, you'll know that we already argued this case. The arguments are all done. We've had our day in court. And at this point, we're just waiting for the judge to make a decision.
Yeah.
So in theory, the aquarium could come to the park board and say, hey, we want to settle this case. Let's drop it. Let's avoid getting a decision on it. But they say they're not going to do that.
Yeah. So, well, we look forward to seeing what comes of that. We'll be obviously keeping an eye on the Vancouver Aquarium case, but obviously good news to it's always good news, I think, when I think we have to applaud sort of progressive decisions that are made, even when they're made by people who previously have been doing things that are troublesome for animals. Anytime we can see progress in society, it's sort of the same thing with, for example, the elephant phase out in zoos. It's the same idea. You can be critical of the fact the elephants were there, that the zoos fought it at a every stage. But on a positive side, you can at least recognize that most of the zoos, like the Toronto Zoo, for example, has recognized we need to get out of this business. Like, this is the business that can no longer continue. So at least they've made the right decision, even if it was belatedly.
Yeah, yeah. And my view of social change in this way is that businesses like the aquarium or the zoo that make money from confining animals, or same thing with firms that make money from battery cage chickens or gestation crate pigs, they're only going to stop these practices when the business case is there, when they start losing money because people are so pissed off about the cruelty. And that's exactly what happened in the case of the aquarium. They made public statements when they made this decision to the effect that they were losing support, they had lost several major donors over this, and that they were losing admissions at the door as well. So it's really a victory, I think, by the public, by people who stood up and said, this is not good enough anymore, stop.
Hear, hear. The other story I think that has caught our attention this week is involves some troubling details about sled dogs. It's on Ontario, correct?
It's in Ontario. It's north of Toronto. There is a sled dog facility there. A couple went there over the weekend and they were sort of wandering around and came across this area where the sled dogs are chained outside with heavy chains to poles. For shelter, all they have is an overturned barrel or a wooden crate, and they're forced to run around to eat, to play, and to eliminate as well in this really small area that's bounded in by their chain. And they posted, the couple that saw this was shocked enough about it that they posted on Facebook, and the post went viral immediately. I always know something's going to be big when people start tagging me on things on Facebook and say, right, hey, what can we do about this? So Sunday night, I think I got about a dozen tags from people who saw this and were just like appalled by it. And it wasn't that surprising to me because this is standard in the sled dog industry. When the dogs aren't being forced to race, they are chained typically outdoors. And there's no Ontario law that prevents that. And in fact, the only requirement is that the chain be at least 3 meters long and that they have some form of shelter and, of course, get food and water and so on. So the OSPCA is investigating. There was especially a concerning thing about a dog who had a very lame looking leg with an open festering wound on it. It was such an obvious injury. So I do hope some action will be taken. If you are concerned about this and you saw the story, you can visit our Facebook page and we've put a post up there encouraging people to take action. You can email the Premier of Ontario, Kathleen Wynne, and also the Minister of Community Safety and tell them that outdoor chaining should be banned.
Yeah, absolutely. I did a lot of research on sled dogs when I was doing some work on a book that I'm writing. And I looked at the BC case, which, of course, which I refer to as the most notorious case of animal cruelty in Canadian history, which I still think it is. Those of you who are unfamiliar with that, just Google sled dogs, British Columbia, mass slaughter, and you'll come up with what goes on there. But learning a lot about the industry, there's no question. This is an industry that is deeply troubled, the seasonal nature of the industry. And, you know, what people don't realize with sled dogs is it's really an economic problem. Again, like the industry is incredibly seasonal and it's reliant on things like snowfall. Mm-hmm. And the number of dogs that they're able to keep is, again, is an economic problem. How many animals can we keep? How many can we feed? How much does it cost to take care of them? And how much money are we making? So in a bad winter, as happened in some of these BC cases I was researching, you're going to have massive problems with the dogs because you're trying to cut down on your costs any way you can. And the way you cut down is veterinary care, food, treatment for the animals, enough staff to keep the animals with the exercise of the dogs. And then there's the natural problems, as you point out, of the way in which these sled dogs have traditionally been kept with chains and things of that nature. So again, it's an industry that's of great concern to us and I think of great concern to a lot of Canadians.
And if you want to know more about this, you can watch an excellent film called Sled Dogs that came out last year. It's by a Canadian filmmaker and she really blows the cover off of this industry.
All right, we better move on.
Okay.
Let's get to our main topic.
Main topic. Here we go. All right. So our topic for the day is something we call federalism, which if you're not a lawyer, you're forgiven if you don't actually know what that means. But Canada's a federal system. That means we have a federal government. We've got different provinces as well. And we've got municipalities as well. So we've got a whole bunch of different levels of governments and they all have different powers. And you might say, well, what does this really have to do with animals? It has a lot to do with animals. And frankly, I didn't myself appreciate how fundamental this is to the field of animal law until a couple years into doing this actual work. So when you've got different governments you have to figure out who decides what they're going to regulate. What's the federal government going to regulate? Which animals is it going to oversee? What types of scenarios is it going to oversee? What are the provinces going to do? Which municipalities can do what? And that is complicated too, because that again depends on what province the municipality is in. So there's all these layers. And so there's the setting of laws, so who decides what laws they can make. And then there's an issue of enforcing laws as well, which we deal with every single day. So what law enforcement authority is going to enforce which laws at which level? And is that going to be federal law enforced by provincial authorities? Is it going to be a federal law enforced by federal farm animal welfare authorities? It's pretty complex.
So let's dig right into it. Okay. I mean, I don't know about you, Camille. When we were thinking about this podcast and we were conceptualizing what did our listeners want, I know what they wanted was deep constitutional discussion about how our governments work. That's what they were clamoring for when they came for animal stuff.
And that's what you guys are going to get
today. What you're going to get today. No, I agree with Camille. I mean, to me, it's amazing how often I deal with federalism questions. So unfortunately, this issue keeps coming up. And I think it's a core problem, really, when you're dealing with animal welfare or animal law issues. The first issue you really got to discover is, well, who has the right to do this? And as we're about to tell you, it's really unclear. That's part of the problem that we have here. We do not have clear delineated lines between who is responsible for animals. And as we're going to talk a little bit more going forward, that has allowed governments to act, and it's allowed governments not to act when it suits their reasons for doing so. So, I mean, perhaps a good place to start when you're understanding how the law works is when you are trying to find who has the authority to do a certain things, we start by looking to our Constitution. Our Constitution sets out the rules for which government gets authority. And the way I like to tell my students in first year is you can assume, imagine that the lawmaking authority, every potential law in the universe is in a circle. Well, our Constitution divides that circle in half and says, well, federal government, you get half the authority, and provincial government, you get the other half of the authority. So if we're just talking about who gets to legislate, the Constitution Act 1867 tells us who that is. And unfortunately, the question that we need to start with is, well, what does the Constitution say about animals?
Well, and you might be surprised to learn that the drafters of the Constitution weren't really thinking much about animals back in 1867.
They weren't. It's sad to know they weren't thinking about animals. I think there are a few references in there to, the odd monkey or something along those lines. They forgot to mention the IKEA monkey. They weren't thinking.
Yeah.
The framers didn't think of that carefully. So we don't have much. It really doesn't say anything.
No, the word animals, I don't think appears in the Constitution.
I'd have to take a look at some of the more obscure clauses, but I'm going to go guess that you're right. There is nothing about your pet dog or cat. But what the Constitution, of course, does say a fair bit about is property. And the two issues that arise here, well, I would argue there are three that need to come up is, well, how do we deal with animals, right? So what we know is the law governing property is afforded to the provinces. So the provinces get to make rules about property. So your first instinct might be that most rules governing animals are dealt with by the provinces. And there's no question that a lot of issues involving animals are dealt with the provinces. The transfer and sale of animals, the regulation of the way in which animals are sold, moved, traded, those things are all governed by the provinces. It is the transfer of property, and they have the ability and the right to do that. But unfortunately, like all things in our Constitution, it's not that simple, because what we also know is that the federal government has authority over two very important things. One being the criminal law, and the other being the interprovincial trade and the idea of trade and commerce. And both of these authorities have been used to exercise legal authority over animals, albeit a bit more unfrequently than Camille or I might like. But no question that the idea of the federal government taking authority over animals is well, well established. So that is why, for example, we have a federal cruelty law in the criminal code. It is pretty well accepted now that some crimes against animals are within the purview of the criminal code. So when we talk about animal cruelty, we are talking about section 445.1 of the criminal code. That's really what we are discussing. Same thing with one of our pet topics, bestiality, which is, again, a crime in the criminal code. So we know that. And we also know, if you've been following the law, that the federal government has set up certain regulations and even laws governing the transport of animals, which involves crossing provincial lines, the idea that animals should be transported in a certain way. Now, the question that arises here is, okay, well, what about the rest? If you follow animal welfare law in any particular way, you know that the provinces have gotten much more active than just regulating the sale and transfer of animals, or, for example, who gets to hold custody of an animal. What they've also done is created their own welfare acts. And that's where things get interesting.
Yeah, that's where it gets very complicated. And before we move on to that, I just want to point out a couple of other constitutional sections that the federal government's hung its hat on to regulate animals in some way. So one is fisheries. The feds have authority over fisheries. And for instance, when you talk about the seal hunt, that's regulated federally because it's considered a fishery. There is some environmental powers as well that they use. And then there's import-export issues, so international trade
Certainly
issues.
Any international welfare issue is customs authority. It's essentially the ability of the federal government to regulate that as well.
Yeah, so what animals can come into the country, under what conditions, and what can be shipped out is another issue. So there's a few different ways there, but in practice, and I guess we'd be remiss if we didn't mention that they do have ability to regulate agriculture in various ways. So, this does play into this idea of transport and of slaughter standards. I think they also, think of that as a food safety health issue, which they have some say over, but there's a bunch of different ways that they get in little pieces of it.
Yeah, I think one of the problems we have here is that unlike a lot of other areas of constitutional law where there have been a lot of litigation to try and sort out who has authority over what, none of that has happened with animals. And I think one of the biggest questions we all face is we've just given you an overview, but the real question is who can do exactly what has really not been tested with animals. It's really unclear the level of division and the extent to which provinces can regulate or the federal government can regulate in particular areas. To a certain extent, the only way to know this is to get a judicial opinion, which means the issue needs to be tested. And as far as I know, there is not a single case governing constitutional law involving animals. So we just don't have answers.
The only one I know of is a seal hunt case actually from the 80s. The Supreme Court, there was a challenge to some federal laws that governed animals, and the federal government did win that. But as far as I'm aware, that's really the only one. There's another issue I think about that helps me kind of conceptualize this whole concept as well, and that's laboratory testing regulation. Okay, so in the 60s, 70s, people started to get concerned about how lab animals were treated, and they saw images coming out from animal rights groups, and they were concerned about it because there's a lot of very worrying things that researchers do to animals. So the federal government was attuned to this. They thought, well, let's try to do something about it. And they got a legal opinion from within, and they felt that they didn't have the jurisdiction to pass any federal regulations about the way that laboratory animals are treated. So they said, okay, well, if we can't do this, what can we do to try to protect them in some way? And what they devised, instead of a comprehensive national piece of regulation, is that they made grants of federal funding for research conditional on complying with this whole non-legal voluntary process of standards that was to be quote unquote enforced by a nonprofit. So now we've got this organization called the Canadian Council on Animal Care that's a nonprofit. It creates these standards for how animals are to be treated in labs. And if you are seeking federal funding, you have to comply with those standards. If you are a private company, you don't, but you can. It's sort of a voluntary opt-in. And this has supplanted the idea of having a national legal regime governing lab animals and regulating their lives. So instead, provinces have picked up pieces in some areas, and it's a very, very patchwork situation. So I use that as an example because I think it really illustrates why, in some cases, it would be great to have a federal law on a specific issue, and how it can be problematic when we don't.
Well, that's a good segue to where we wanted to talk about this question of standards and opportunities, or opportunities and deficiencies, because you're absolutely right. That's a great example of some of the benefits and disadvantages of a federal system. There is no question that if you want to look at this glass half full, what we have here is a situation where the provinces or the federal government could both operate. And there's no question that the provinces have, decided to up their game. What we see across this country is provincial animal protection acts that do a lot like, I mean, if you go back, honestly, 50 years, we were only looking at the Federal Act. I believe the Federal Criminal Code was more or less the exclusive animal protection law in the country.
Yeah, provinces didn't really have their own legislation. And in the last couple of decades, they started creating it, but not really before that.
Correct. And you can argue that the reason they did that, as I've read in some of the literature, is because of the deficiencies of the federal law. So the provinces started creating these different laws, which are animal protection acts, or in Ontario, the oddly named Ontario SPCA Act for some reason. But essentially, these acts set out, again, standards by which animals must be kept. And you can look at this in a number of ways. One way is to look at this as a very positive opportunity. Obviously, what it does is it allows provinces to create their own particular rules. And in some of these provinces, we've seen some rules that look pretty darn progressive. Some of them have banned things. One of my favorites, the PEI law that recently banned tail docking in that province. To me, that's a big win. That's a great law, right? That's exactly what we're looking for.
And PEI also recently banned circuses in that same round of revisions. And that was a first in the country. And it's a really big deal.
Exactly. And I think if you look at this in terms of opportunities, there is no question that the ability to try and persuade a provincial government to put in some progressive protection legislation for animals is a really useful thing, because if you can leverage one province to do that, it possibly becomes possible to leverage that across the country. We haven't seen that as quickly as we might have hoped, but there is no question that the speed by which provincial governments have been willing to reform their provincial packages is increasing. There's no question.
Yeah, and if you just look for a practical example, about a year and a half ago, people tried to get the criminal code amended, and there was a private members bill to improve some of the deficiencies in our federal law. And it was really, really difficult to do anything because there was such a degree of opposition from industries who thought it was going to threaten them. And the federal government is a massive, massive bureaucracy. It's really difficult to get anything through. The government has to deal with so many different issues at the federal level of such national importance that animals usually falls down to the bottom. There's more MPs that you have to lobby and to worry about. But if you look at the provincial level, there's fewer issues that occupy their attention. There's fewer people to lobby. And usually there's less opposition from industry because it just affects one specific area. You know, if you look at PEI, the population's 140,000. It's not going to be as much of a financial blow to an industry that might be regulated.
Yeah, there's no question it has been, as a practical matter, much more difficult to amend the federal laws. It's just been a lot harder. You're right that industry comes in much much stronger way, and it's just been much harder to actually move those things forward. So what we can see is there are definite benefits to doing this. Now, what are some of the negatives of actually going down this road? We talked about it's great. We can have the provinces come in. We'll create all these laws. And with a national regime, in theory, it's nice to have this unified idea that, you know, the criminal code applies to the whole country. Wonderful, but a lot harder to get implemented. Well, what are some of the disadvantages of going down the provincial route?
Well, there's a lot. Okay, so, you know, one issue, obviously, is this patchwork that we're left with. So you're left trying to research the statute of every single province to see what's going to fly and what's not going to fly under the law. Every single province has its own enforcement agency as well that deals with these issues. So it's not like there's one national animal police force that you can call if there's an issue. You've got to figure out who in what province enforces what law. It's always different. The regimes are completely unique across province to province. Usually it's an SPCA or a humane society that enforces the law. But sometimes it's the RCMP. Sometimes, you know, in Manitoba, they're an outlier. There's their own sort of provincial animal protection agency. So it's really complicated to figure all of that stuff out. And then when you actually look at the prosecutions of animal offenses, I think that's where we get into the most problematic issues.
Yeah, this is one that's troubled me the most. I get troubled about this for a lot of reasons. One is the message that's being sent, and the other is the actual practicalities of what it means to prosecute. We should make no mistake about it that the direct consequence of what we've been talking about, this idea that the federal government has stuck to a very narrow range of what we call animal cruelty, which has directly led to the provinces to beef up their laws. No doubt they have. Most animal protection laws in a lot of the provinces, BC and Ontario in particular, they carry hefty penalties. You cause your animal to be in distress, you're looking at a penalty of a maximum of 2 years imprisonment. And that's compared to the federal law, cruelty against animals, which has a 5-year maximum. Now, I should point out, that's not true in every jurisdiction. This whole idea of jurisdiction shopping, not every province has come to the table in the same way. Here we are in Alberta, where the Animal Protection Act has some nice sections in it. Unfortunately, there is no jail time possible. It's a maximum of a $20,000 fine. So there is a real difference with taking provincial prosecutions in Alberta, because you don't have that potential to get as good a penalty. But there are other concerns as well. I mean, the real question is, what does it mean to do a provincial prosecution? And we should make no bones about it. These days, most prosecutions that you hear about, when you hear in the news that somebody's being prosecuted for cruelty to animals, I want to leap up and say, not exactly.
Actually
being prosecuted for a provincial violation. What does that mean?
Well, it's conceptually really important. And I think a lot of people, this is missed on them. You hear that word animal cruelty and the media always reports that there's animal cruelty charges. And you think, oh, that's sort of this general animal cruelty thing. But it actually makes a really big difference. At the federal level, the criminal code governs morality, basically. The offenses in the criminal code are morality-based offenses. So we say that it's immoral and improper and antisocial behavior to cause harm or suffering to an animal. But if you look at the provincial offenses, what provinces can do, they're not supposed to enact morally-based offenses. Well, they're supposed to regulate standards. Yeah, they can't. The basic idea is they can't.
If we got to the point where we believed, and I guess we'll come to this in just a moment, that the provinces are actually regulating immoral standards, well, they have traipsed into the federal authority. And our constitution makes it clear that you're not allowed to do that. So stay tuned. More on that in a minute.
Yeah, and provinces are supposed to set standards for behavior. You're supposed to meet these standards under provincial law, but it's not supposed to be so much of a moral issue if you breach the standards. It's just that there's a regulated standard that's supposed to be met and you have to do it. So when you look at provincial animal welfare acts, they tend to be much more prescriptive in nature. They say what you have to do for animals rather than preventing some sort of general suffering that the criminal code would worry about.
So, and they're also not designed to punish your intention. One of the core things about criminal law is that you intended to do something wrong, or you crossed a standard of criminal negligence that was so high that you deserve to be punished in certain circumstances. And that's a really important thing. When people intentionally harm animals in a way that's disturbing to us, we should punish them under the criminal law. That's traditionally the way we've always done that. And provincial regulatory law does not attempt to do that. It doesn't care about the intention. It simply punishes the failure to keep up to standards that we deem to be acceptable.
Yeah.
Now, on a certain level, you might say, who cares? They're being punished either way. But I think we do care, right, Camille?
I do think that we care. And I think that we should care. And more people should be up in arms about the fact that prosecutions are being shifted to these regulatory standards instead of these morality-based offenses. So, you know, let's just take a couple examples in recent years where we've seen provincial charges instead of criminal charges for really egregious abuse. So one I think that was in the news a lot, and probably a lot of you are aware of, is Michael Hackenberger, the former owner of the Bowmanville Zoo just outside of Toronto. He was caught on videotape by a PETA undercover person.
Dead to rights.
Dead to rights. He says, I'm trying to cause this tiger pain, and he's seen whipping a tiger. So in my mind, that is 100% clear. He's intentionally inflicting suffering on a tiger, which is a criminal offense.
It is hard to imagine him not meeting the criminal standard, but they did not prosecute him criminally, correct?
Nope. They laid provincial charges against him. Ultimately, those charges never reached the trial. He had a stroke and they withdrew it sort of on compassionate basis. They decided it wasn't in the public interest to prosecute him. So that's not as much of an issue. But the fact that they proceeded
provincially. But the charges
provincially
being laid in that way is an issue. I agree with you. I don't take issue with any. I would never second guess the Crown's decision to pull charges for whatever reason is humanitarian. But certainly the charge itself is questionable.
Yeah.
And it's become a bit of a trend. Is that fair to say?
It's become a huge trend. The other one that's top of mind for a lot of people, I think one of the cases in Canadian history that's had the most media exposure is the Chilliwack Dairy case in BC.
Upsets me a great deal.
Very upsetting. And Mercy for Animals had an undercover agent on that property. The employee filmed multiple employees of a dairy farm, the biggest one in Canada, abusing cows. The employees were hitting the cows with pipes. They were kicking them. They were dragging them around. It was abuse, again, that I would consider to be of a criminal nature. It was intentional abuse. And again, it was
it's
a regulatory
provincial charges.
Prosecution.
Yeah. And perhaps, again, you think we're just splitting hairs. Let's talk a little bit about some of the impact of this, because I think there are I'd argue three major impacts. The first is the message is very clear. What's happening now, what troubles me in a great way, is we're shifting the idea of what cruelty to animals actually is. What's happening is the cruelty to animals that we would normally prosecute criminally has become provincial offending. So it's moved down. So essentially what we've done is we've said, well, this is provincial offending. Well, if that's provincial offending, what is cruelty to animals at this stage? Like, what is the point of having the federal criminal law? Obviously, there will be some egregious cases, usually involving dogs and cats, that are gratuitous. You know, the terrible cases I cite to my students, microwaving a cat, beating a cat, shooting a cat with an arrow, those get prosecuted under cruelty. But if you use the provincial law to deal with cases that are essentially intentional cruelty, my concern is you lose the idea of using the provincial law for things that still need to be prosecuted because of improper care, treatment, et cetera. What happens is you've shifted the bar downward. And I'm wondering, well, where are the prosecutions of the dairy cows that involve poor treatment of dairy cows, but not outright abuse? Well, you've set the standard with what the regulatory offense is now designed to cover. And you've essentially shifted everything downward. And that troubles me a great deal.
Yeah, I'm deeply troubled by that as well. It's a worrying trend.
There are more direct effects, correct, Emily? What about the consequences of provincial regulatory offending?
Well, what ends up happening when you get to the penalty stage, and you know, obviously this is a general statement, but generally people who are convicted of provincial offenses as opposed to criminal ones, they face little, if any, jail time. It's typically probation and or a fine.
And because it's not a criminal offense.
Yeah.
That's essentially the decision to prosecute under the provincial standard says it's not criminal. So why should we punish you for the wrongness of what you did? We're just punishing you for the failure to comply.
Yeah, a fine is much more appropriate, theoretically, under a regulatory prosecution.
So there's no criminal record. Is that right, Camille?
And there's no criminal record. So somebody convicted of operating a puppy mill in Quebec under provincial legislation can move to Saskatchewan. They can open up shop again. And authorities in Saskatchewan are not going to have any idea that that person was convicted in Quebec, because records of these types of offenses don't get transferred around very easily in Canada.
Come on, Camille, you're fear-mongering. That sort of stuff never happens.
It happens all the time,
especially
actually.
On the Saskatchewan-Alberta border, the Ontario-Quebec border. Punishing, it's a real, real problem. And it goes further than that. I mean, the provincial acts allow for some imposition. In my opinion, when you have criminal offenders like this, the most important thing you can do is impose prohibition orders. And we have seen, it is the one area. I went to a conference a couple of years ago, and I said the one thing Canadian courts have been doing really well is imposing lifetime prohibition orders, 20-year prohibition orders. If you harm an animal in a serious way, you can't own animals. Well, no way, not under the provincial offending. First of all, the prohibition order doesn't transfer to the province next door.
Yep.
So that's a real issue. And then they hand out much lower prohibition orders because, again, they're not punishing the moral wrongness. Do you know how long the Chilliwack offenders got, Camille? Any clue?
Oh, it was not very long.
Yeah, it was. It varied for the offenders. The worst of the offenders got a 2-year prohibition, or a 3-year. It was 2 or 3 years, and the other offenders got 1 year. A 1-year prohibition for literally, if you watch the video, beating an animal. Why would we allow these people to go back in a position of trust where they're taking care of vulnerable individuals? This is not good. So we have all these problems involved with the sentencing, and it's a deep concern to me. But believe it or not, it goes further, because right now, I have absolutely no idea what is federal and what is provincial offending. And again, some people might say, who cares? Anything that's going to get them convicted. And my view is that's not the case. I think we are heading eventually to a serious constitutional challenge that is going to say your provincial standards are really impeding on the federal government's ability to punish cruelty to animals, because really you're punishing the exact same conduct. And frankly, that constitutional challenge is already underway.
It is. There's a case in an Ontario courtroom just outside of Ottawa in a place called Perth. And it's a challenge by a man who has animals. He is concerned at some point about being inspected or having the SPCA go after him. So he's challenging the whole OSPCA Act, the entire provincial animal welfare regime. And he's making a few different arguments. There's ones about sort of more structural arguments about whether the agency, the OSPCA, is subject to appropriate accountability and transparency.
Subject for another podcast.
We'll be talking about this again for sure. But the one that's of interest to us today is he's saying that the OSPCA Act is, in essence, criminal in nature. It's a morally based act punishing moral offenders. So we're intervening in that case, or we're going to seek to intervene on it. The application's coming up in the next few months, and we'll see how that goes. But, you know,
Let's just say I'm concerned. I'm not a constitutional federalism expert, and I know enough to know, because I do some research in this, to know that the courts will bend over backwards to allow both jurisdictions to regulate. So I don't want to say it's impossible and the provincial laws are clearly going to be struck down, but I do think it's a risk. I've looked at some of these provincial laws, and some of them, literally one of the PEI provisions is literally, it talks about cruelty. It's illegal to be cruel against animals. I'm like, how can you do that? That's literally the wording used in the federal code. So I have some questions. I want to point out a couple last things. We've been going on this for a long time. One is the political aspect of this also troubles me, because when you have jurisdictions doing different things, what drives me the most crazy is it has allowed the federal government to abdicate its role on fixing our cruelty laws. So my point is, if you think back to what we said earlier, the provinces have come in to fill a gap. And there's no question. I understand why they did that. It was with the best of intentions. But what's happened is the federal government says, well, there's no need for us to fix anything. Our terrible cruelty law, which I have described as literally the worst in the Western democratic world, it's a terrible law. It's full of all kinds of antiquities, and we can't get it fixed. No one will move forward to fix this law. And I think part of the reasons is the provinces are doing it. You go over there. And if the provinces aren't doing it, they can say, well, the Fed should be doing it. And we have this, you know, abdication, and everybody says, no, you do it. No, you do it. And as a result, animals don't get the protection they need.
No, buck passing is rampant in this situation. No one wants to take the political risk of doing something about animals when they can just pass the buck.
Yeah, absolutely. So in terms of protecting animals, that's a concern. We'd be remiss if we didn't discuss a few other aspects of federalism that we think are important. And I know one for you, Camille, it's of great concern. And it's ironic, we're going full circle. We started today talking about my good friend, Yasmin Nakuda. What does the federalism problem deal with things like Yasmin Nakuda and her decision to raise as many monkeys as she feels she is entitled to raise?
Okay, so we've been talking a lot about the federal and provincial issues, but there's also municipal jurisdiction to do a lot of things respecting animals. So it depends on what province you're talking about, because the way that municipalities get their authority to do anything at all is via a grant of power from the province. So municipalities are all sort of set up by a statute at the provincial level. So each city in some cases, and certainly each province is different, but there have been some high profile municipal cases. Some of you guys will remember the Toronto shark fin ban. Toronto took a really firm step in the right direction by banning the possession of shark fin within the city. That was in 2011. And some restaurant owners who wanted to serve shark fin challenged it. And they unfortunately won that case. Animal Justice tried to intervene, and the judge wouldn't let us in the door in that case. The judge said that the case was about food and not about animals, and we had no expertise in food. That's another issue for another day.
Got that, everybody? It's about food, not animals.
Because they're dead, I guess.
We have to be careful of that distinction. It's one, you know, yeah. I like to raise all the time in class. It's about food. It's not animals.
Yeah, we'd like for them not to become food, but...
Hey, stop talking crazy, Camille.
Crazy talk. Anyway, so these issues can have serious effects on what municipalities can do and cast a real chill if the courts strike down a case like this. I can't picture an Ontario municipality taking these steps in the future at this point.
Yeah, there's no question that chill issue is a large one. I mean, the municipality issue is really interesting across the board. There is, in a lot of ways, it's great. You say municipalities, well, you can regulate all sorts of things until you can't. And as much as I love municipalities getting on board, when it comes to exotic animals, we've seen the problems with municipalities regulating. It's great. Toronto regulates. Fantastic.
Yeah.
So move out of town. Move across the city line. Cheaper out there too.
Yeah. So the background to this is that Ontario, in my view, has completely abdicated its responsibility to do anything about exotic animals or zoos in this province. And as a result, what happens is that when an exotic animal gets loose, the municipality is the one who has to deal with it. They've got animal services officers who've got to go out there and pick up that animal. So municipalities, usually in response to some kind of complaint or incident, they enact bylaws saying you can't have an elephant, you can't have a tiger, you can't have an alligator,
a monkey.
Snake, a monkey.
So they drive that monkey to the city line, drop him off over Yonge and Steeles, and say, fare thee well, young soul.
So the IKEA monkey case is a perfect example of this. The IKEA monkey was seized while in Toronto city limits because it was illegal to have a monkey there. And then the IKEA monkey's former owner moved to the Kawartha Lakes, which is a region with no exotic animal bylaws. And she can legally, at that location, own multiple monkeys, which she now does.
Yes. But the only thing I'll say about that is she has to suffer getting into Toronto through the traffic. So really, she is paying a sort of penance.
Yeah, as all Torontonians do.
If you have to fight that traffic coming in from Kawartha Lakes, I don't envy Miss Nakuda. This we could go on and on about federalism. We'll probably have to cut it off there at the 30-minute mark. I think that's more federalism than any of us can take in one day. But as you can see, I hope you've seen that there are a lot of interesting issues here. I have no doubt we will return to some of these going forward. But if you have any comments or questions on this, we'd be happy to answer them during our next episode.
Ask us questions.
Heroes and Zeros.
Okay, welcome to Heroes and Zeros.
Everybody's favorite segment. I have no idea if it's anybody's favorite segment. I just like saying that.
I think it's mine.
Everybody's favorite segment. Camille, you're going to lead us off today. We got a hero.
I am. So, you know, it's usually pretty easy to find a lot of zeros. Sometimes finding heroes can be a little tough, but I did manage to find one today.
We're all looking for heroes, Camille.
There was a really cool article in the New York Times about something I was not previously attuned to, and that's the fact that the Netherlands has their own national animal police force.
Go Netherlands. Go Woo! Netherlands.
And apparently, this is really cool history. It was set up as sort of a political negotiation when there was some coalition government discussions. As part of those negotiations, one party was pushing this idea that there should be a national police force dealing exclusively with animal issues.
Wait, Camille. We have a national police force. It's called the SPCA. Did I miss something? Isn't that our national animal police force?
Peter's joking because the SPCA is provincial.
No offense, SPCA people listening to this, but frankly, you are not the police. And the decision to accord, this is very different. We're not talking about people who are trained in animal issues. We're talking about police officers who are first trained in being police and then get trained additionally in animal issues. Isn't that correct?
Yeah, there's a very big difference. These are national police members who have specialized training that let them go into situations and really do
access
a lot of
to police databases, access to search warrants. Like they're police officers.
Yeah, in Canada, humane societies and SPCAs, they're not always police officers. Sometimes they're considered peace officers individually, but they're not police forces. And
not
that really
quite
matters.
The same thing.
They're also not state funded to any significant degree. They always have to fundraise to make up at least some of their operating costs. But in the Netherlands, you've got this amazing force that's out there policing all of these situations.
In an ideal world, that's the model we want. In every ideal world, you want a neutral state agency that has no stake in the game, that is not trying to raise its own funds, and that has expertise in animal issues, investigating crimes against animals.
And ideally, you want one agency so that the public doesn't have to start Googling and call a lawyer to find out where they can file a cruelty report. Because when you have all these agencies at the federal, provincial levels, and they're all different, it's really complicated for any average person to make a report.
But luckily, Camille, our agencies don't tell you if you call them to call the other agency because they're more... Oh, wait a minute. They do? Geez, I've really got to get up to speed on how this works.
There's a lot of buck passing.
Buck passing?
It's
God,
like
no
one wants to deal with the animals.
I wonder if that's a federalism problem. Dun, dun, dun.
So bravo to the Dutch. I really love what you're doing.
Yay, Dutch. Go Dutch.
Hopefully we can emulate you someday.
All right, for every hero, there is a zero. And this week's zero just came out screaming to us. Not only is this zero one of the worst offenders of animals, against animals in Canadian history, it fits into nicely into our federalism theme today. We're awarding our zero of the week to farmer, it's hard to use that term, farmer Ben Stein of Tavistock, Ontario, who managed through his incredible farming techniques to kill 1,265 pigs, not through a barn fire.
Not
tip of the hat
fire.
To last week's Heroes and Zeros. No, not through a barn fire, simply by starving them to death in what I like to refer to, as I've done in other scenarios, as what I call an apocalypse farm. I call it an apocalypse farm as a way of saying that usually most investigators will investigate a farm when it reaches the state that it looks like the apocalypse. Then they'll start to investigate.
Yeah, if there's a couple skinny animals, they might not do
anything. No. Warnings.
But in this case, it's really bad. And Peter, so far as I'm aware, I think this is the worst case of animal cruelty in Canadian history that was ever prosecuted on a mass scale, numbers wise.
I'd argue that as well. When you're talking about the number of victims here, I mean, we've seen other cases, shooting of sled dog, where 20 animals suffered over a very short period of time. We've even seen neglect cases. I've never seen one as long as this. For 1,265 pigs to starve over a prolonged period of time, where the inspectors were forced to waste weights deep in water, animal waste, and hog carcasses to actually get to the victims of this crime. We are talking long-term prolonged abuse.
This is not a couple days someone forgot to give these pigs water. This is deliberate.
This is a long-term neglect where the farm has gone under, and instead of seeking out help because, oh yes, you are entrusted with the care and the duty to care for vulnerable beings. By the way, where is that duty? Let me check my various laws where that duty, because clearly, Camille, this is contravenes the duty under Section 446 of the Criminal Code, if I'm recalling correctly, to provide adequate food, shelter, and water to your animals, correct? So clearly, criminal charges against Ben Stein.
Well, of course, they should have been laid, weren't they? Weren't they, Peter?
No, why would we lay criminal charges against the worst possible offender in Canadian history? Really, in terms of scope and long and magnitude, no. He did not microwave a cat, Camille, so we are not going to punish him with criminal charges. Let's bring in the regulatory offending, which is what the SPCA did in this case. Let's charge him under regulatory charges. That's what's going on. Sorry, let me just say for the record, I shouldn't just say the SPCA. I don't know what went on. It may well have been the Crown and Simcoe who made that call. So I don't want to point blame at any one group. I don't know who did it, so I just don't know. But let's just say whoever made that call, I was going to swear on the podcast, really, because it's a ridiculous call.
I'm sorry.
It's not acceptable. There is no reason to do this. If this guy wants to fight it, you've got all the evidence in the world. Criminal charges are required here, in my opinion. I could not say that more strongly. This is an apocalypse case. If you're not going to use the criminal law to prosecute a farmer in this circumstance, you are never going to use the criminal law. And that is unacceptable. The level and magnitude of suffering of these animals over a prolonged period of time screams out for morality. And what's amazing is, what drives me really crazy is, this is one of the few cases where farmers across Canada and I would be in agreement. Everybody would look at this guy and say, it's unacceptable. We're not piercing hairs here. We're not splitting hairs about like the treatment, the sow stalls were too small. We're talking about 1,200 animals starving to death. There's no question here. So why aren't we prosecuting?
That's Peter, do you think if it was 1,200 dogs who starved to death that there would be criminal charges?
What a question. It almost answers itself, Camille, doesn't it? What a wonderful question. Would it happen if it was 1,200 dogs?
Yeah, we're talking, of course, about the double standard.
Yeah, it's just
so
ridiculous.
So many of these cases that we've discussed today on the podcast that are prosecuted provincially involve animals used by industries. They're not pet cases, which are typically prosecuted criminally. So there's a huge double standard, and I think this really reflects it.
Absolutely. So that is our zero of the week. I'm going to say our zero of the week, Ben Stein. And by the way, just let me pull one more thing out about Ben Stein. The defense lawyer who spoke on behalf of Ben Stein raised the things about Mr. Stein was suffering from depression and Mr. Stein was suffering from therapeutic issues and was, according to the evidence given in the court, he was suicidal. So I'm going to assume that was true. I'm a defense lawyer as well, and I'll assume that was true. And let me just say for the record, that doesn't change my view of whether he should be charged criminally one iota. I represent clients who are suffering from mental health issues. I've yet to hear that being a reason why they will be dropped to from large-scale criminal offending to regulatory offending. No question that his depression or suicidal tendencies should be taken into account in sentencing, without a question.
That's the appropriate place.
No question. But the idea that if anyone's thinking, and I'm not saying it was suggested just because it's in the story, that that's a reason to make it less serious offending, you've got to be kidding me. We've got to send a message, a very strong message, that this type of offending is criminal and needs to be treated that way. I'll stop ranting now, because I've seen this before. It's not the first time I've seen this sort of thing take place. And for some reason, the idea that if you're a dog owner and beat your individual dog, you are a criminal. But you are a farmer and you take care of 1,200 animals and starve them to death, you are not. Give me a break.
Yeah, the idea that there's no criminal record in this case is offensive. So there we go.
That's our heroes and zeros. Now, I'm going to tell you, normally today we would be moving to our Q&A segment, but this has been a very long podcast. And our next podcast, as we talked about, is a full-on Q&A extravaganza. So we are going to bypass. Apologies to our listeners who sent us some wonderful questions, but we're going to try and tack those questions on to our next podcast because we've gone on very, very long today. So that's a good place for us to sign off. Thanks to our listeners for tuning in today.
You can subscribe to the Pod in Order podcast using iTunes, Stitcher, or any other favorite podcatcher. And we encourage you to leave a rating as well if you like what you hear.
And please, to all our listeners, please share our podcast on social media so other listeners can learn about it and listen to it. If you enjoyed today's Pod in Order podcast, please consider making a donation to Animal Justice, which makes all of this possible. You can find me on Twitter at @PeterSankoff or on Facebook at Facebook/Professor Sankoff. Also, you can visit my website to watch some of my videos on animal law at petersankoff.com.
And you can find me on Twitter at Camille Labchuk, that's Labchuk. And you can find Animal Justice on Twitter at Animal Justice. We're on Facebook as well and Instagram and all the other social platforms. We always enjoy having Twitter convos about the show or any other animal law or political topics, so please check us out.
And thanks to our producer, Shannon Milling, for the technical stuff that makes this come together. Thanks, everybody, and have a great day.